Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the February 25th, 2025 meeting of the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Our first order of business today is to approve the minutes from our February 20th meeting. And Representative Smith, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I actually did, so I move to accept those minutes.
Thank you. Representative Smith moves the minutes from February 20th. Any corrections or additions? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of the motion to adopt the minutes from the February 20th meeting signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. We have a just a reminder for the events for this week. We have an informational meeting today on liquor and gaming. We may or may not be seeing bills of this nature as the session moves on. Given some of the action in the Senate, we may not see things like gaming in sportsbook betting. However, what they do over there is independent of what we do over here. But we wanted to get a chance to get an overview and discuss everything from the lottery to the different kinds and forms of gaming that we have here in the state of Minnesota. So what we'll do at that point is get a chance to talk about those. Tomorrow we will not be meeting as a committee. Thursday, here we go again. On Thursday, what we will do is we will have a discussion on mandates, and the department's going to be back with us of commerce, and we're going to dig a little bit deeper into that. We'll have more of a conversation on insurance mandates and what those look like and the impact on premiums. So with that, we're going to start our conversation. Members, in your packet, there are a number of different handouts, and I'm going to ask our testifiers as they go through to cite the handouts so you can see them. One handout that is in your packet, it says Modernization Minnesota Liquor Laws, and it looks like this. It is from the retailers, and we do not have anyone that's going to be testifying from the retailers, but they did ask to have this submitted in your packet. Otherwise, the other documents that are in your packets will have a presenter that supports and walks through those documents. So that is the lay of the land for the week, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to nonpartisan staff, who's going to take us through an overview of gaming and alcohol this morning. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris Clown. He's our first testifier. Welcome. If you identify yourself for the record, and then we will proceed with your testimony. Thank you. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Clayman with the House Research Department. I'm here with my colleague Alex Hagler, and we're going to discuss Minnesota system of liquor regulation, and then Ms. Hagler is going to complete the presentation on gambling. We do have some...
Mr. Cohen, just for one second. House staff is working on the feedback issue we have with the mic, so if you can just bear with us, we'll hopefully get that resolved shortly. Thanks, folks. Mr. Clown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have some publications on our website, the House Research website. If you just navigate to the Commerce section, there are four or five publications on liquor. If you're interested in learning some more details on that. If anybody needs a refresher on certain terms that are applicable in the liquor regulation area, feel free to take a look. For new members, I typically just highlight that there are two different kinds of retailers. On-sale retailers sell alcohol for consumption on the premises, so that's your bar or your restaurant, whereas off-sale retailers sell alcoholic beverages to individuals for consumption off the premises. So that would be, for instance, a liquor store. Could be anybody who has an off-sale license.
Mr. Clum, I'm just going to interrupt you for a quick second here. When you talk about the retailers, the same establishment could be issued both an on- and off-sale license. Is that correct?
Generally speaking, that's correct, although in some cities, if they're small enough, you can get a combination license, which allows you to do both on- and off-sale. But, yes, typically on- and off-sale is not connected. There are some exceptions, again, for small producers. So for instance, a small brewer could have a tap room and at the same time make a limited amount of off-sale liquor too.
And I'm also thinking about in some of the smaller communities, you may have an on-sale that also has an off-sale license to be able to retail that as well. It's not you're one or the other. You could be both, and I just want to make sure folks understand that, because you get outside the Twin Cities Metro, and that's not an uncommon model to see in some smaller communities. Thank you, Mr. Clown.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Yeah, so there are certainly exceptions to that. The regulatory system for liquor is primarily driven by the states. This is because of the constitutional authority that the states were given under the 21st Amendment. There is a role for the federal government. It is a fairly large footprint, but it's limited to permits and labeling at the federal level. Otherwise, regulation of interstate commerce is largely a state issue. There are some constitutional limitations. However, in this area, states cannot act in ways that are economically protectionistic. And so that is policed by the or regulated by the federal judicial branch as well. To really get a sense of the reason why the system of liquor regulation in Minnesota is the way that it is today, you have to go back to the pre-prohibition era, which was largely seen as being an era where the industry was not very well regulated. That was at least a perception. So, for instance, you had vertically integrated monopolies that were seen to be promoting a culture of overconsumption. You had various people raise concerns about culture of inebriation. You may have exclusive retailer arrangements where this, you know, you might have a regional monopoly who is encouraging a retailer that they own to serve as much alcohol as they possibly can, and this was seen as a net negative and a situation that caused a fair amount of social harm. That at least was the perception. For many years prior to prohibition, states really struggled to regulate liquor. The federal courts typically took a dim view of state actions in this area, so Congress did step in a handful of times to try to provide the states with the authority they needed to do that, and they passed a couple congressional acts that you can see on the slide, but those were typically narrowed down or watered down by the federal courts, so it was very difficult for the states to actually impose the types of regulations that they wanted to impose. Ultimately, this situation resulted in the 18th Amendment of the Constitution being passed. That was in 1920, lasted for 12 years until 1932. The prohibition prohibited the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors in the United States. There's probably a perception that this was somewhat porous because it did not necessarily prohibit purchase and consumption. And when prohibition was operationalized through the Volstead Act, home brewing was allowed, for instance. And again, it was seen as a somewhat porous type of system. Feel free to ignore the third bullet point. I intended to take that off the slide. But this was, again, operationalized under the Volstead Act. Prohibition ended in 1932. The 21st Amendment to the Constitution was ratified in 1933. There's a brewery, I think, out in California called the 21st Amendment Brewery. This is where that name comes from. For purposes of the state regulatory system, the important reform under the 21st Amendment was Section 2. Section 2 is really the foundation of all state regulatory systems for the regulation of alcoholic beverages. And the language in Section 2 is very similar to the Webb Kenyon Act that was on a previous slide. This is one of those acts of Congress that was never fully implemented. And that, again, that forms the basis for the state system of liquor regulation. Again, now after prohibition, states were able to figure out the way that they wanted to regulate the sale and consumption of alcoholic beverages in the liquor industry. There were a couple different models for doing that. One of them is called a control state model, where the state actually controls certain aspects of sales and distribution. So they might actually own a distributor, control the distribution of alcoholic beverages. I think there are 17 states that have a control state model. Otherwise, you have licensed states. I think that's probably a better term than three-tier system states. But you have licensed states where you have private entities that are licensed by the state to perform certain functions in the industry. And Minnesota is a three-tier state. And the three-tier system of liquor regulation divides the industry into three separate levels, where each business on each level is required to be licensed. That's intended to solve some of those pre-prohibition problems that were perceived by the states to have occurred in the past. So in a pure three-tier system, and Minnesota has a modified version of a three-tier system, the industry is broken up into three different levels, so manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. And the idea in a pure three-tier system is that those three tiers are not going to mix. And so a manufacturer who's licensed as a manufacturer cannot own an interest in, for instance, a retailer. So the idea is that the three tiers are separate.
Mr. Colum, before you go on to your next slide, the three-tier system certainly gets a lot of conversation around the legislature, and there's differing opinions by legislators about whether the three-tier system should be maintained or whether the three-tier system should be modified or completely abandoned. The purpose, as I understand it, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, that it was put in place to get away from some of the pre-prohibition events of managing liquor and who was involved in which aspects and market rigging and some of those different kinds of things, or limiting competition. Could you speak to those issues? I think that's an important thing that this committee needs to understand, the history behind that, because there are outside forces that are having conversations with legislators about keep, abandon, or modify.
Sure. Yeah, I think the three-tier system was intended to solve a lot of those pre-prohibition era problems. So one of the ways to solve one of those problems would have been this vertical integration problem, where you have regional monopolies, where you have a manufacturer who's maybe a regional brewer who owns a number of the bars in a particular area, and so they're encouraging as much consumption as possible through that retail outlet. By separating that manufacturing tier and the retail tier, the idea there is that you can moderate that influence from the manufacturer on the retail sale of alcohol, and you can solve, or at least attempt to solve, some of those perceived overconsumption problems. You know, the other thing that the three-tier system does too is it allows, at least in Minnesota, allows for pretty significant local control as well. And so you have local governments that have the authority to determine who gets a license, for instance, or where an on-sale retailer or an off-sale retailer can be located in a particular city. And again, that's intended to modulate that culture of alcohol consumption in a way that gives local governments the ability to address issues that they see potentially of social harm. And yes, also, I think the conventional wisdom is that with a three-tier system, you have transparency. You're better able to create a fair system of competition in the liquor business as well. You can also control the safety of the alcoholic beverage products that are being sold in a state, and it can function to address or promote harm reduction strategies too. I think that three-tier system is designed to address a lot of those issues that people saw with that states saw with that pre-prohibition era, that culture of overconsumption.
Thank you, Mr. Colum. Just one more question for you on this, because I think this point needs to have some clarification for members so they can understand and then form their own opinion on the importance of you know, maintaining, modifying, or eliminating the three-tier system. In this day and age where you have fewer manufacturers of, say, beer or spirits and different things because of still being in the manufacturing area, but there's been some mergers and acquisitions and things, and you also have national retailers, you have national restaurants and things. It is possible that they could also be involved in an integrated system where they could acquire one of these beer manufacturers, or a big box retailer could, or one of those food retailers could end up acquiring that and have integration, and they would then basically control the product flow in their retail space or the restaurant space, and so the options that are available could be reduced or severely limited. Same thing of buying the liquor stores and limiting what kind of product is going to go on what shelf space. We have a very robust microbrewery business in the state of Minnesota, and I think that that's allowed to exist because of the three-tier system, where you have to be in one of the three tiers, because if you're not, and you were controlling the liquor stores, you could put all of your product in there, and there wouldn't leave any other space, and you would have agreements that say, yep, can't take anybody else except us, and you would really severely limit this growing and prospering business within the state of Minnesota. I don't know if there's anything that you want to comment on what I said, or clarifications or things to add to that, but that's always been my understanding of the three-tier system.
Sure, yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah, I think there's an argument that with a regulated system like a three-tier system, you get more consumer choice potentially, because you don't have one particular player in an industry that can dominate the retail sale. And so with each tier being separate, you can get potentially more competition. Consumers can go to a bar and they can get, you know, a wider array of alcoholic beverage products. On the local liquor store issue, there's a law that limits ownership of an exclusive liquor store to just one owner per city. So you can only own one per city, and I think that also probably promotes a greater range of competition. So on the retail side.
And that's very important distinction as well. And the larger your city, the less impact that's going to have. The smaller your city, the greater impact is going to have if you have limitations on the number of license holders, because you may only have one license holder in a community, just given the fact that it's a smaller population base or demographic to draw from. Thank you, Mr. Klum. I appreciate that clarification. Continue, if you would, please.
Sure. As noted previously, Minnesota does not have a pure three-tier system. I think it's fair to characterize Minnesota's three-tier system as a modified three-tier system. I won't go over any of the other points, but again, this is intended to solve a lot of the perceived problems in the pre-prohibition era. The third bullet there notes that there are exceptions for small producers. This is why it's, I think, fair to characterize it as a modified three-tier system. So for instance, small producers, and this is regulated in a variety of different ways, but brew pubs, microbreweries, and so forth. The regulatory system allows some of those functions at each of those individual tiers that are typically separate in a three-tier system to combine or to in some ways collapse into each other. And so, for instance, a small brewery is able to manufacture. If they're under a certain size, they can engage in some distribution as well. And they can, of course, have a tap room and make on-sale of alcoholic beverages. They can even make some off-sales of alcoholic beverages as well. And the history of legislation on this, I think, shows that there's a lot of effort that the legislature's put into figuring out exactly where to draw the lines in terms of functions of one tier bleeding into another tier for some of these exceptions for the small producers. Again, this, I think, reflects likely just a market shift towards small producers and microbreweries and so forth, where maybe they're coming into the industry with a different kind of economic model. And so the regulatory system in Minnesota has tried to accommodate that. Getting close to the end of my slides here, Mr. Chair and members, but I thought I'd just make a note about some of the recent changes in the liquor regulatory system over the years. One note that I don't have on a slide is that Sunday sales passed in 2017. In 2022, there was a set of, I think, somewhat significant changes to the liquor regulations in this small producer area. There were changes to cocktail rooms. There were also some changes to micro distillery off sales. There was a growler cap that was lifted. That's an off-sale provision for small brewers. Also, brew pubs can sell growlers. There were some changes to the range of off-sale products that a small brewery can make from their premises. And the last bullet point there, I thought I'd put on there just to indicate that liquor stores are exclusive. In other words, they can only sell a statutorily prescribed range of products. And so a liquor store can only sell essentially what the legislature says that a liquor store can sell. And in 2022, liquor stores were given the authority to sell citrus fruits and glassware. So if you're at a local liquor store and you buy a lemon, that's from the 2022 change. Going back to local authority very briefly, I think the gist of this is that municipalities enjoy a certain amount of local control over the liquor industry. They can control, for instance, where liquor is sold. They issue a lot of the on and off sale licenses. They can be more restrictive. Bullet two may be worth calling attention to. Cities, if they're under a certain size, they're able to completely control the retail sale of liquor, both on and off sale under the terms of the law, if they want to. Those are the municipal liquor stores, so they can monopolize essentially retail sale of alcoholic beverages in their jurisdiction. And this is a feature almost of a control system that bleeds into the three-tier system that we have in Minnesota. It's like the control state slide, if you remember that. Thought I would just point out that this committee typically hears in the liquor area a number of what are called special local liquor laws. These are laws that are intended usually to address a very specific situation at a local level. It could be a state law that's preventing a local government from issuing a license that it wants to issue. It could even be a local charter provision, potentially even an ordinance that they want the state to provide them the authority to not have to follow in order to issue the license that they want to issue. So typically these laws don't amend the general liquor laws of the state. So it doesn't, typically don't modify from a general standpoint the three-tier system of regulation or any other aspect of that system. I think the Division of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement is going to discuss some aspects of state regulation of liquor that they handle, but there is a shared enforcement authority between the state and local governments as well. Quick note on dram shop liability. Every liquor retailer, with some very narrow exceptions, every liquor retailer has to buy dram shop liability insurance. There's a statutory right of action for harm caused by a liquor retailer. If they make an illegal sale of an alcoholic beverage to somebody, that person then gets intoxicated and causes harm, they're liable for those damages. So liquor retailers are required to purchase insurance for that. Lastly, Mr. Chair and members, I thought I'd bring up a unique feature of Minnesota's system of liquor regulation, which is 3-2 beer. Minnesota is the only state that has 3-2 beer laws on the books. It's around 4% alcohol by volume, and it's regulated with a somewhat lighter touch than other alcoholic beverages. Different regulations would apply to things like temporary licenses and so on. Mr. Chair and members, that concludes the liquor regulation part of this presentation. There are further resources if members want to take a look at those on their own. They should feel free to do so, or feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions.
Mr. Klum, thank you for your time. I do want to just ask you for a couple of quick other clarifications, then we'll see if there's any member questions. There are different types of licenses that are issued, and this may or may not be within your purview, but so generally speaking, you have on sale, so you serve, sell, and consume on premises. Off sale, you purchase on site, you remove that from the premises, and it's consumed elsewhere. Periodically, the committee will get bills that are coming in that will say, for example, and there's one that's in queue this year, and we've had these before. In the Minnesota state system, they want to have a liquor license to be able to sell liquor at a sports arena. Or you'll maybe hear people saying, well, there's a caterer's license that we have, which allows a vendor to move from site to site to site and carry that license with them versus being in a fixed brick-and-mortar location. Could you shed just a little bit more background and light on those kinds of things, since there are some things that are in queue that bills that have been introduced that deal with those kinds of questions?
Sure. Mr. Chair, yeah, I think the first thing to say is that a municipality can only obtain a liquor license under the municipal liquor law statutes. And so if a municipality wants to obtain an on-sale license for some municipally owned facility and they want to be able to serve alcoholic beverages at that facility directly, then they would have to, they'd have to get a special law in order to do that. But as you mentioned, they potentially could hire a caterer as well to do that. So there's a liquor catering license that exists. That's tied to an existing on-sale license, and so but that allows the holder of the caterer's license to, you know, cater certain events under the aegis of their catering license, and also under the which is connected to that on-sale license. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the, I think you had a second question on there too.
Sure.
That I lost track.
Sure.
Of, but
I use the example that. From time to time, we get requests for liquor license to be issued at certain facilities or certain locations, for example, Minnesota State, where they may have a sports arena or some other type of venue, or they may be hosting events where they like to be able to have the sale of on-sale alcohol there.
Yep. So, Mr. Chair, members, yeah, sorry. I think I'd answer that question generally and just say that for on-sale licenses, those are limited to certain establishments. So a liquor license can only be issued to a person who's running a certain establishment. So when those are statutorily prescribed, so like a restaurant or a hotel or a bowling alley or so on, a theater. If you're want to make a say on sale of alcohol and you're not one of those statutorily prescribed establishments, then you can't do it unless there's some other provision that comes in and lets you do that, say through a caterer or somebody else.
Thank you, Mr. Klaman. And again, number of questions. I know we have one from Vice Chair Perryman. Let me know if there's others. Vice Chair Perryman.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. Can you just give a high-level discussion about when, and I'll use Total Wine as example, they have many facilities. What is the statute or what are the legal ramifications if they move product around the state to different stores? Is that allowable? Is that something we're talking about? Just wondering how that works.
Mr. Klum. Mr. Chair and Representative Perryman, that's currently not allowed. So there's a law that requires that when a wholesaler distributes alcoholic beverages to a liquor store that they have to store that on their premises, and so they're not allowed to move that around. There have been bills that have been heard in the Commerce Committee over the years to allow a limited amount of some of those transfers, but at present the local or the state statutes don't allow that.
Follow-up, Representative Perryman.
Thank you.
No follow-up.
No follow-up. Thank
Representative
you.
Finke.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your presentation. I just am curious if you can, it's my understanding that, you know, alcohol sales is an industry that just increases year over year. Every year we sell more liquor. And I'm just wondering, is that true? Is that true for on sale? Is that true for off sale? Can you just sort of set the, set that landscape for me?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Finke, unfortunately, I don't have that information with me right now. I can certainly I'll look into that and get back to you. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. I think the way to do that would be to look at tax revenue collections under the various alcohol excise taxes to see what the growth is, if any, in those industries. But I apologize, but I'll have to get back to you and the committee on that.
Follow-up, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, I would appreciate that follow-up. I'm very curious if that's accurate. A cursory Google search indicates that we sell more alcohol every single year we are alive. So I'm just curious if that's true.
Representative Finke, I can tell you anecdotally, we sold a lot more during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Representative Chan, then Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair. Can you give us an idea of how many vendors are in each of the tiers?
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize, Representative, I didn't quite hear the last part of your question.
Can you give us an idea of how many vendors are in each of the tiers, the three tiers?
Mr. Coleman, it has dumped the pan this morning, isn't it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I don't have that information. That's something I could certainly look into. It's possible that somebody from, I don't want to put them on the spot, but it's possible that one of the testifiers from the Division of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement may have some idea of that information, but certainly something I can look into. Mr. Chair, my colleague, Ms. Hagler, she brought her Minnesota tax handbook with her, and so I may be able to get at Representative Finke's question. In fiscal year 2023, on the alcoholic beverage excise taxes, there was a total of $110 million in tax collections under those excise taxes. And in fiscal year 24, that went up to $112.3 million. So there was a slight increase there. But I can still get a more detailed look at that. So,
Representative Cha, follow-up?
No, I just can have someone get that information to us. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question, and maybe I missed it in the presentation, but is there a special license for like a nonprofit group, a church group, or a local fire department to get a license to operate a beer garden, or is that outside of the realm of any kind of licensing?
Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, there are, I believe that's covered by the temporary licenses. Which can be issued under some very narrow circumstances for nonprofits, for instance, and a handful of other groups. And it may have to be in conjunction with some sort of community festival as well. So I think so. State law does allow for temporary licenses similar to those that you're describing to be issued.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Coleman, just to follow up on Representative Hewitt's question, that's per organization for those temporary licenses. They may be able to be issued up to, say, three licenses, but that doesn't necessarily mean the premises is limited to three. For example, if you have a community center in a community or some other place, and maybe a community center is not the right idea, but you have a public building or a place where it doesn't have a liquor license and an event is being held there, maybe in a park or something along that line, you could have maybe the city festival or, you know, the Kiwanis Club is doing an event and that's another liquor license, and then the JCs or the, you know, Rotary Club or whatever the case may be. It's not limited to three times or whatever the case may be for the park. It's limited to the individual organization to the number they're entitled to. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe that's correct. So the number of temporary on sale licenses is restricted under state law. But yeah, I don't believe there's anything that prevents, you know, multiple holders of temporary on sale licenses from operating at the same event. So if that's incorrect, I'll get back to the committee on that.
Very good. Other questions for Mr. Coleman this morning? Seeing that and hearing it, thank you, sir. And we're going to move over as our slide presentation will show us to gambling in Minnesota. And we have with us from House Research, Alex Hagler. Welcome to the committee. If you'll identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Again, welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Hagler. I'm with House Research, and I staff the gambling regulation and tax areas. So I'm just going to give kind of a high-level overview of the different types of gambling that is lawful in Minnesota. under the Constitution or under statute. Charitable gambling is statutorily authorized under Chapter 349, and then the state lottery is authorized under Chapter 349A. The parimutuel horse racing is authorized under the Constitution and also codified in Chapter 240, as well as the card club operations that racetracks are able to operate. And then lastly, there are tribal casinos that operate here in Minnesota as well. For charitable gambling, under statute, certain charitable organizations are authorized to conduct charitable gambling. This is also called lawful gambling. Organizations are required to be licensed to do so and need to obtain a permit for the premises on which they conduct their games. Some organizations own their own buildings, and some organizations lease their buildings or space at a bar or restaurant to conduct the games. Booth operations involve an employee of the organization in some kind of enclosure where that is separate from the food or where drinks are sold. Bar operations involve an employee of the bar or restaurant providing the sales and prize redemptions for the games, and some organizations operate both types of operations. Authorized games that are allowed to be played are pull tabs, paper and electronic bingo, paddle wheels, raffles, and tip boards. Statute dictates how the licensed organizations are able to spend their gross proceeds from the gaming activities, which is their gross receipts minus prizes paid. They're divided into allowable expenses and lawful purpose expenditures. The allowable expenses have to relate to the conduct of gambling and usually involves compensation to employees, rent paid for their booth or bar operations, and game development, whereas lawful purpose expenditures include taxes and contributions to their charitable missions. The agencies that oversee charitable gambling, there are a few. The Gambling Control Board issues licenses and permits. They conduct audits and approve games. The Department of Revenue collects taxes and also conducts audits when necessary. And then the Division of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement investigates illegal activity and criminal violations. And you'll be hearing from them later on. The state lottery under Chapter 349A is overseen by its own state agency, the Minnesota State Lottery. Lottery tickets are sold by licensed retailers in person. The revenue generated by the lottery is collected by the state lottery, and the agency is required to retain a portion of the revenue for prizes and the agency's operation. And the remainder goes into both the general fund and the environment and natural resource fund in the split you see here on the slide, the 60-40 split. And that's a constitutional dedication to that environment and natural resource fund. There's also an in-lieu sales tax that the state remits to, or the agency remits to the general fund. And those are, they're just divided between various legacy funds, the majority of that revenue. For a parimutuel horse racing is authorized under the Constitution and authorized on-track betting on horse races. And the horse racing is overseen by the Minnesota Racing Commission, who issues licenses and oversees regulation and collects taxes. There are two licensed racetracks in the state, both offering live in-person horse racing as well as simulcast racing, where viewers can watch and bet on horse racing that occurs outside of the state. For example, you can watch the Kentucky Derby at one of the racetracks. Proceeds from horse racing are deposited into the state general fund as well as the Minnesota Breeders Fund. Both racetracks are authorized to, or licensed to, operate card clubs at the tracks, and the license and regulation of those card clubs are also governed by the Racing Commission. Currently, there are card-themed table games authorized there that include table games and electronic games. And a portion of the revenue generated from the card club is required to be used for purse payments. For tribal casinos, there are currently, I believe, 19 tribally operated casinos throughout the state, operated by the 11 federally recognized tribes in the state. As stated at the beginning, these are not regulated by statute, but these are actually negotiated through compacts between the state and each tribal nation. And these compacts dictate which type of games can be operated at the casinos and provide any structure for state regulatory authority, if any, and revenue sharing agreements, if that is also agreed to by the state and the tribe. And then lastly, I'll just throw in a note about sports betting. Since the 2018 Supreme Court case that held a federal law prohibiting states authorizing sports betting to be unconstitutional, since then 39 states have offered either retail or mobile sports betting or both, but it still remains unlawful in Minnesota. And then just a quick slide here about certain resources in House Research. There's a large publication on American Indians, Indian tribes, and state government, gambling regulation. There's a section that starts on page 55, and that's helpful, that describes the kind of relation between the state and federal law and tribal gaming. There's a charitable gambling publication from 2015 that's a bit old and before my time, but a lot of what's in there is still currently applicable. And then lastly, there is a publication on the charitable gaming taxes that was updated in 2013 to account for the legislature's authorizing reduced rates for those taxes. And Mr. Chair, that concludes the gambling portion.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler, for your testimony today and the insight on gaming. Members, questions for the testifier? Representative Dotsa.
Quick question I would have is, what is the annual revenue that we generate, state of Minnesota generates off of the state lottery?
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dotsa, I don't have that. I don't think it's in the testimony book. I think it's elsewhere. But I will get back to the committee with that number for the state lottery. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Asset, follow up. Okay. Any other member questions for the testifier? Thank you for being here, both of you, today. With that, we are going to bring up Alcohol and Gaming Enforcement Division, Carla Sincota, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I have my apologies if I'm not getting that correctly. You will have the opportunity to correct me if I am incorrect, and I'm good with that. Good morning and welcome. You'll go ahead and state your name for the record, and then we'll proceed accordingly. And
yes.
Then, Mr. McManus, we'll get to you at the time that it's in your presentation as well, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to make sure that on the agenda that people know that both of you are up there at that time, and then we'll bring you on when it's your part of the presentation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I need to apologize. Our slide deck is a little out of order. May I have just one moment?
Absolutely. Take as much time as you need.
Are we starting with the gambling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carla Sincota, and
I'm just going to ask you to pull the microphone just a little closer. Thank you.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carla Sincata, and I serve as the Director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. I would first like to thank you and the committee for inviting us to be here today. We are grateful to have an opportunity to speak about our division and highlight the good work that we do. Our division sits within the Department of Public Safety, and as you know, we regulate two highly visible industries, the liquor industry and the gaming industry. These two are constantly evolving, and our goals are to maintain stability within those industries and to maintain integrity in both industries. We hope to share our resources with other agencies and to provide investigative assistance to local units of government.
Ms. Sincata, if I could just interrupt for 1 second. Members, this is the one that we're looking at here, just to make sure. You've got a lot of the handouts, so it's the one that has the front cover that looks like this. Thank you for the indulgence. Please proceed.
Of course. My focus this morning is on the gaming industry, and as previous testifiers noted, we work very closely with the Minnesota Gambling Control Board, the Minnesota Lottery, and the Minnesota Racing Commission. We complete cooperative investigations with those agencies. We also work closely with the 11 tribes throughout the state at 20 casinos. We complete investigative work, and we also complete the criminal history background checks for key management employees and personnel at the request of the gaming regulatory authorities. We're a small division. We have a staff of 28 with 10 sworn law enforcement personnel. And I would be remiss if I didn't add that we have a new member. This is Canine Bia within our division. Bia is a currency detection dog. She's gone on 41 deployments since she came to our division in the fall of 2022. And she has recovered over $777,000. The reason why I bring this up is because with a currency detection dog, we are able to complete our criminal investigations more efficiently and thoroughly. And we do that because instead of spending hours and hours inside of someone's home or on their property, this dog is specially trained to find the currency that we're looking for so that we can make restitution to victims. Part of our work, Minnesota, like most jurisdictions, requires a pretty comprehensive background investigation so that the entities who want to participate are thoroughly vetted to get a gambling-related license. The licenses we issue are primarily for the manufacture and distribution of gambling devices. The statutes are noted here. These give us the authority to complete those backgrounds for vendor contracts, licensing. Again, this is at the Gambling Control Board, the Lottery, and the Racing Commission. The background investigations are lengthy. They usually involve a pretty thorough look inside of a person's their personal finances, the business, corporate business finances, financial relationships and associations. We require that all of these are met because of the statutory requirements that would not allow for a person or a company to get licensed in this state. As noted earlier, we provide investigative assistance to local units of government. Gambling laws, state and federal, are complicated. They're kind of putzy, and these investigations can be long. Oftentimes, local authorities don't have the time or the resources to put into these type of specialized investigations. We wanted to highlight the work that we do with our sworn. So we do have a forensic examinations available to us. We use informants surveillance. We're able to complete subpoenas and execute search warrants. Some of the investigations that have been in the news just in the last few months to highlight We work really closely with the lottery. There are people who are bad actors that steal these tickets. And again, we're the investigative agency that will work through these. We look at illegal gambling. And again, we work closely with the Gambling Control Board to look at any illegal gambling or lawful gambling fraud. This year, we completed 124 illegal gambling cases, 16 lottery investigations, 5 at the Minnesota Racing Commission, and 44 with the Gambling Control Board. We also complete the tribal audits as required by the Minnesota Tribal State Compacts. We've completed over 18,000 slot machine accounting system reviews. What that means is that every slot machine within the state of Minnesota has been checked for compliance to the tribal state compacts. We've completed 525 hands-on video games of chance and blackjack inspections. That concludes my presentation, but if you have any questions, we are happy to do our best.
Members, questions for Ms. Encada. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sports betting is not yet legal in Minnesota, but Minnesotans, as a practical matter, can still go online and go to FanDuel's or whatever and do it. Do you ever try an enforcement against these national organizations that are offering it in Minnesota?
Ms. Encada.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do. When we receive those complaints, we do begin and initiate criminal investigations. Oftentimes, though, these investigations are hard to come to conclusion because the money is going out of state or even out of country.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Elkins, follow-up. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple, thank you for being here. I had a couple quick questions. You said in 2024, there was 124 illegal gambling events. I just was curious if you could just give us a little snippet of what that looks like. And then you said that you do all the tribal audits. And how detailed are those audits and what kind of information does that give you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, for the 124 illegal gambling investigations, those can be anything from a slide up where somebody is selling pull tabs through Facebook when they're not a charitable organization. They could be anything from a higher level, more organized sports betting scheme that you might see at a local bar or restaurant. It's more than just putting your name on a square and saying that you're going to have a friendly wager with another patron at the bar. These are the folks that are still selling the paper tip boards where they're running numbers for games, if that sounds familiar at all. So those are the type of investigations that we run for the illegal gambling. In regards to the audits, these are required by the Minnesota Tribal State Compacts, and the things that we look at would be forward-facing documents that govern what the income is, the state of the business for the tribe. I would also, sir, note that the reason why I'm hesitating is because the information contained within is protected data.
So it's not public that we can see?
You could see the forward-facing documents that they provide on their websites, but we do not collect that information.
Okay. Representative Vinsberg, and follow-ups?
No, thank you.
We have one more member question that I'm aware of. I just want to ask a question of you, Ms. Encada. The summary that you have is 24. Is that calendar or fiscal?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that was calendar year 2024.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. We've seen a rise in online raffling for, like, automobiles and stuff like that. How is that regulated?
Ms. Encada.
Online raffles, I believe if they are lawful, are regulated through the Gambling Control Board. If they are not lawful and licensed through the Gambling Control Board, then they would be considered illegal gambling. If we receive a complaint about that, that is something that we investigate cooperatively with the Gambling Control Board.
Representative Chau, follow up?
No, thank you.
All right, I see no other member questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Hood, I did have you on the list. My bad.
Mr. Chair, I know you're in a hurry, and I'll make this a quick question. Recently, I had a charity in my area that actually had a fairly sizable amount of theft from a burglary. Is there a requirement that has our charities make those deposits to a bank? Like, how much can they hold? Is there any requirement to that, or can they hold as much as they want of cash on hand?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, I would defer that question to the Director of the Gambling Control Board. Thank you.
Any other member questions? If not, we will move then to Mr. Magnuson's testimony. And again, then we have Ms. Laura Wade, who will finish the formal part of the presentation. If there's anyone present who would like to offer some input to the committee, we'll have a little bit of time at the end for that as well. Mr. Magnus, if you would go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
And just to double check, is this going to be your packet?
That's the one.
Okay.
Correct. Excuse me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike McManus. I am a program administrator of the state's regulatory alcohol enforcement agents, the system. I think we'll find that House Research stole a little bit of my thunder, but I'm hoping the two presentations will complement each other, because I'm going to go a little bit into what type of business models occupy each tier. And contrary to what the alcohol industry might tell you and some of my colleagues, I have not been with alcohol regulation since 1933. I started it in 1987, moved into the Liquor Control Division in 1989, and have been in the alcohol regulatory system since 1989. I wanted to share with you our mission statement. Excuse me. And I know you see a lot of mission statements, so I just wanted to emphasize a few lines in there that reflect the type of investigating and regulating that we do. The alcohol industry, the business interests, work very hard to maintain stability and integrity in the alcoholic beverage industry in Minnesota. And our division and our agents work with them. We license them, we educate them, we regulate, and we enforce when necessary. As was mentioned earlier, the state's alcohol regulatory system was born at the end of Prohibition in 1933. It takes a little bit of time for an amendment of the Constitution to be ratified. So I wanted to talk a little bit about 3-2 beer, non-intoxicating beer. Non-intoxicating beer was born at the end of Prohibition to allow the federal government actually passed it initially, and all states had it, to allow for the transition back to the manufacture, wholesale distribution, and retail sale of intoxicating liquor. 3-2 beer, or non-intoxicating beer, kept that label in statute when you reference 3-2 beer statutes until, I would say, probably around the mid to late 1990s. When the legislature removed the term non-intoxicating from the title of the 3-2 beer statutes, because there is still alcohol in 3-2 beer. As House Research mentioned, 3.2 by weight equates to about 4% alcohol by volume. And if you look at a lot of our light beers, if you look at how they're labeled, you'll see that some of these light beers are labeled as 4.1% alcohol by volume. That 0.1 is what's keeping that beer out of our 3-2 licensees' establishments as we speak. But this beer as House Research mentioned, was always treated as a less regulated product because of the non-intoxicating nature. But if you look at the definition of intoxicating liquor found in 348.101, the definition of intoxicating liquor is over 3.2% by weight. At the end of Prohibition, the federal government tasked states with regulating the alcoholic beverage industry for product primarily within that state, whereas the federal TTB, as it is now, or the alcohol and alcohol ATF, alcohol, I can't remember what they were called, but the TTB regulates product crossing state lines. As the states took over regulating, some states remained dry for a while. They wanted to study the issue. Other states, as House Research mentioned, became control states. The most common control state is where the state occupies a portion of the three-tier system. There are still control states today. They occupy the wholesale distribution tier. Alcohol coming imported and manufactured goes to the state, who then sells it to retail. Minnesota chose a different route. Minnesota chose the route and became a licensed state. Minnesota entrusted the manufacture, wholesale and retail and import of alcohol in Minnesota to the private sector. The state chose to issue license and regulate through licensing and taxation. Again, Minnesota has a three-tier system: import, manufacture, wholesale distribution, and retail sale. As you'll see as I go through some of the business models, Minnesota is not a pure three-tier system, I'll explain that as we move forward. So who gets an alcohol license in Minnesota? The language is fairly consistent across all three tiers. You have to be 21. You cannot have any unlawful interest in a member of the other tier. You cannot have had any felony conviction within 5 years of the application. You cannot have any alcoholic beverage licenses revoked within 5 years of the application. And you must be of good moral character and repute. Now, I will say, in my 36 years of alcohol regulation, I've never seen a license denied on that basis. That's a little bit of an antiquated term. We do have some clarifying language and rule, but that, like I say, as long as I've been here, that's never been a basis for a denial of a license. It seems somewhat subjective. So the first tier we'll talk about is liquor manufacture. One of the largest liquor manufacturers in the state, liquor manufacturers don't necessarily have to have a still. They don't have to distill spirits. They can rectify, they can blend, they can mix. One of our largest manufacturers brings in bulk spirits by the tanker load, train or truck, and they cut the proof, they flavor it, they mix it, they rectify it, and they create what's called liqueurs. UDV vodkas you see in the liquor stores are rectified in Princeton, Minnesota. They create a liqueur product. And there, it's a very impressive plant if you ever get a chance to see it. If you do get a chance to see these industry members' facilities, I would recommend it. It's very impressive. The next would be the large spirits, the distilling plant. As our micro distillery industry grew, some of the businesses started to grow with it. And they needed to, they're moving past the 40,000 gallon proof gallon spirits cap of the micro distillers. So there was a need to address the larger distillery. Now these will eventually or could reach the size of our liquor manufacturers, but they do have stills or multiple stills, and they also are allowed to have a cocktail room and keep that cocktail room they had when they were micro distillers, and I'll explain that as we move forward. The micro distillers are the smaller distilleries. They were here before the large distiller. They are a small micro distiller and a micro distiller. They produce what is called a proof gallon, premium distilled spirits. And they are capped on the amount that they can produce. The smaller one is 20,000 proof gallons. The larger is 40,000. None of our spirits manufacturers can self-distribute. They have to use the wholesale distribution tier. They can provide samples. When you would say you take a tour of their distillery, they're allowed to provide small samples of the spirits that they produce. They are also allowed a retail cocktail room. That's literally a retail on-sale bar that they're allowed to have on or adjacent to their distilleries, where they the local city issues them an on-sale intoxicating liquor license to serve the spirits that they manufacture. Distilleries can have off-sale. They have a limited amount of off-sale. They can sell up to 750 milliliters of spirits in varying package sizes, with the 750 bottle being the top largest size, to any one person on any day. The off-sale license is also locally issued and state approved. Our brewers. We have three classes of brewers. We have the microbrewer that can produce up to 2,000 barrels annually. We have the small brewer that can produce up to 3,500 barrels annually. And we have the Minnesota brewer. That would be our large brewers that produce over 3,500 barrels annually. They can produce as much beyond that as they wish. The brewing industry can distribute with a wholesale license up to 20,000 barrels annually. And I will admit, when I meet with brewers, once they reach that large brewer, they'll tell me they don't have a lot of interest in wholesaling anymore, because wholesaling is a lot of work. Anyone that worked in the wholesale industry, a fleet of trucks, hauling kegs of beer and cases of beer up and down stairs and into coolers, the large brewers will tell you, you know what, we need wholesalers for that. Brewers are allowed on-sale tap rooms. Like the micro distillery, the tap room is a city-issued on-sale license. It can be located on or adjacent to the brewer. All of our Minnesota brewers can have a tap room. The cap on being able to get a tap room is 250,000 barrels annually. Our largest brewers are not near that cap. So all of Minnesota's breweries can have a tap room. Again, city issued. Brewers are allowed off-sale growler. They're allowed a couple different off-sale licenses. They can have a growler off-sale, which is a specific package. It is a 750 milliliter bottle or a 64-ounce container. Under federal law, a bottle includes cans, which allowed the state to allow our brewers to sell crowlers. A crowler is an aluminum 750 milliliter can, similar to the bottle. That was important back, I would say, it was like 2012 or 14. There was a bottle shortage, and our brewers, our microbrewers, were running out of, the large brewers like to buy up inventory, so the small brewers needed something in addition to glassware to put their beer in. So crowlers were born. There's sealed requirements and labeling requirements. The consumer needs to know what they're getting. The smaller brewer, the microbrewer, and the small brewer have the option of also a package off sale, where they can sell the same types of cans and bottles that you might see in a liquor store in those sizes. Most of our brewers are opting, these are two separate off-sale licenses, and most brewers keep it that way, because you'll notice there's a limit on the number, 128 ounces per day of these canned and bottled products. If you didn't have the independent growler off-sale, your growlers would also be subject to that limit. So this language literally allowed the brewers to have both off-sale options, they can hold both licenses. We have our wine manufacturer. When I started 100 years ago, the wine manufacturers were the large, they were literally wine manufacturers that might be doing, we had a couple up north that did large production. What you might see more now is a wine manufacturer or a craft winery located in a city. As we'll be getting to, but Minnesota, the majority of Minnesota's wineries are farm wineries. But if you're not on a farm, you'd have to be a wine manufacturer. So your winery might be located in a city, and it might be a craft winery, a smaller scale. The wine manufacturers, like the farm winery, can retail the wine that they produce from their winery at on and off sale without an additional license. That's found in Minnesota statute 340A301. It's hidden in there, so you have to look for it. But our wine manufacturers have that same right as our farm wineries. They cannot wholesale. The farm winery truly is the one license that I can think of that crosses all three tiers. The farm winery is literally is for a farm. It's on agricultural land. They manufacture, they're limited to 75,000 gallons of wine a year, whereas our wine manufacturer has no limit. They also can retail the wines that they produce at on and off sale with no additional licenses. They can also wholesale to retail, other retailers in the state, the wine that they manufacture with no additional license. And they can also apply for a retail on-sale intoxicating liquor license issued by the city or the county to sell other alcoholic beverages at retail. So it truly is a license that crosses all three tiers. What people don't talk about a whole lot is the importer's license. The importer also occupies the manufacturing tier because the importer license is for product imported into the state. So Anheuser-Busch, Brown-Forman, these are, they're manufacturers in their home state, but they're licensed as importers in Minnesota. And they import their product to wholesale in Minnesota, who then sells to retail. All product manufactured or imported into the state must have a brand label registration within the state. That lets us know what it is, who made it, and what's in it. And it's an online system that retailers can look at, law enforcement can look at. You can search a product and find out who brought it here, what's in it, what's the alcohol content. Where that's important sometimes is with retail licensing. Like we might have a wine and beer license. I'll get to that in a little bit, but we have a wine and beer license which can't sell spirits. Well, we have a lot of specialty cocktails or specialty drinks out there, seltzers, different types of products that may actually be wine, considered a wine or a beer-based product. So this system, this registration helps identify what products can be sold where. It also aids in regulation. The Minnesota Revenue knows what's here, knows who's made it. The fact that they all go through the wholesale distribution tier tells us how much. This is just a picture of unlicensed, some things that our agents have run into with unlicensed manufacture in the state. That garbage can is actually the still. The wooden barrels aren't too bad. I see those in distilleries. But as you can see, the facility is not very clean. That's probably a Department of Agriculture nightmare with regards to commercial grade equipment and cleanliness. But that was an unlicensed facility that our agents investigated. We investigate creativity in the industry. What you're looking at there on the slide is called iron-rested gin. It's literally a distiller had gone across the street to a local junkyard, got a bunch of metal parts, and was soaking gin in these parts. They were filtering it, but the product that you're seeing our agents pour out there was product embargoed by AG that we ordered destroyed, we were worried about it being fit for human consumption. I don't really want to get a tetanus shot before I have a glass of gin. Next to that,
Mr. Magnus, two things for you. Number one, you know, what doesn't kill you will make you stronger. But we do have one more testifier, and I do want to take a little bit of public testimony today, and I know you've got maybe a dozen and a half slides left.
Sure,
so, I can. If I could just ask you, I don't want to rush it, but I just want to kind of help manage the clock here for folks today. So,
well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I need all the help I can get. I can be windy. So, what was next to that was actually a still, not a beer keg, and it wasn't vented anywhere, just straight up in the ceiling. The wholesale distribution tier is a very important tier. Everything goes through wholesale. That's how the state can effectively regulate the product. I want to touch on brew pubs real quickly. Brew pubs are retailers. Brew pubs predated our craft brewing boom starting in 2010. The brew pubs were here first. If you think about it, think about a brew pub as a retailer with a limited amount of rights to brew beer for the bars and restaurants that they own, whereas our production brewers have a limited amount of retail. We'll get into the retail licenses. They are three local authorities issue and collect fees for these licenses, the 3-2s, on sales. As was mentioned earlier, the city can occupy the retail tier with municipal liquor on or off sales, and the cities issue temporary licenses, what we talked about a little earlier. Cities may be more strict than the state. They do this. They might limit more further, put limits on how many licenses they allow in their jurisdiction. A license is required to sell alcohol commercially or serve it to the public. Licenses are not a commodity. The city or the county issues me the license. I don't own it. I can't just sell it to you. I would sell you my business and surrender my license to the city. The city would reissue it. I can't just pick my bar or liquor store up and move it. I got to let the city know where I'm going. What if it's not properly zoned? So I don't necessarily own that liquor license. The issuing authority does. We have several different types of on sales. I'll move real quickly. But we have the full liquor. We have wine and beer. We have 3-2. These fees are set city with guidance and statute for wine, beer, and 3-2. Typically, what's licensed is what's called a compact and contiguous licensed premises. It means the actual restaurant building itself, any attached decks or patios. For our golf courses, the entire golf course is a licensed premises, with the exception of public roadways or the parking lot. Different types of business models that can have on sale: hotels, restaurants, bowling centers, clubs, exclusive liquor on sales, theaters, convention centers, resorts addressed recently, resorts, baseball fields, stadiums, and racing facilities, auto racing facilities. I won't go through everything that the exclusive off-sale can sell. We covered that earlier. They can sell items allowed by the legislature in the exclusive. That's your neighborhood liquor stores, where primarily you're seeing spirits, wine, and beer for sale. We do have cities of 10,000 and under can issue, and counties can issue a combination license. That's an off-sale issued in combination with an on-sale. Like out greater Minnesota, you'll see bars that might be able to sell a case of beer as well from behind the bar, or they have a little bottle shop attached to the bar. Our agents conduct pre-license inspections and routine inspections. Primarily, we want to make sure that what the public is consuming is safe. We want the public is supposed to know what they're consuming. The beer taps must be properly labeled as to what's in the keg. We can't keep infused beverages in a jar for a year and keep serving it. There's time limits. And we want to make sure there's no fruit flies get into open pores. When you see that the garnish is there and you put open pores, if they're not sealed properly, you'll see a lot of fruit flies in the sweeter liqueurs. Our agents conduct criminal investigations and regulatory investigations. The regulatory investigations result in civil penalties, whereas the criminal investigations may result in criminal charges. Our common types of investigations would be unlicensed sale, unlicensed import, unregistered brands, or illegal retail sales. Earlier, it was asked about the transfer of product between retail. Retailers cannot act as wholesalers. They cannot sell or transfer product to other retailers. If they end up on a tax delinquent or credit delinquent, no ship list, wholesalers can't sell to them, and they can't buy from other retailers. This is salvage inspections. We inspect product damaged. Damaged product cannot go back into the market. It has to be deemed fit for consumption, and it literally has to be pristine like new to be allowed to be resold. What you're seeing there is product that was involved in a bar fire, heavy smoke damage, and you're also seeing product where the industry is very self-reporting. That's damaged product at wholesale. Well, that one bottle you're seeing is literally a liqueur that the cream curdled in the bottle because of bad seal that had to be returned to manufacturer and destroyed. The next product was a bad seal resulting. That sediment is not on the outside of the bottom of that bottle. It's on the inside. That's it. Thank you.
Mr. Magus, thank you so much. We do have one member question I'm aware of. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Thank you for your presentation. I have a question that's not about alcohol, actually. I'm just curious. I'm sober. I'm 5 months sober next month. And I was at Total Wine trying to buy non-alcoholic beer with a license that was expired, and I could not buy it. I don't blame that person. But why can I not buy a six-pack of non-alcoholic beer at my grocery store?
In my experience, Mr. Chair, Representative, in my experience, if that beer is labeled as it that contains under 0.5% alcohol by volume, that is not an alcoholic beverage and should have been able to be sold to you just like a soft drink. However, our retailers, we do best we can to educate them, and in overabundance of caution, sometimes the retailers get very strict. And they could have a policy of not selling it. There's no law against a retailer having a specific policy.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm not blaming the Total Wine folks. They have the person actually felt quite bad, and I don't blame them. I'm in my 40s, and it's a non-alcoholic beverage. I'm more interested in why are retailers, like why do sober people have to go to the liquor store to buy non-alcoholic beverages?
They don't. Mr. Chair, members, Representative, it's non-alcoholic.
Yeah.
You should be able to find it in any retailer that would be willing to carry it. Grocery stores have it.
Okay, so it's really just a matter of, like, these grocers don't want to carry it? I mean, they don't, right? Like, I can't go buy the Bauhaus's excellent non-alcoholic beverage at any grocery store I've ever seen. So that's just a decision they're making, you're saying? That's not a licensing question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's my understanding, yes. I have learned over the years that shelf space is premium to retail, so they do have to make decisions on what they're going to stock or not.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr.
McManus.
Thank you for being here to present today. I did have a question around the inspection enforcement side of it, specifically as you're getting into like wineries, distilleries, microbreweries. I know you were talking about Minnesota Department of Ag along with. Are you also working with Minnesota Department of Health on those inspections as you guys are going through that? Are all of you going through at the same time?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I've learned is the Health and Ag Department's authority varies. I think for our production tiers, where our brewers or distillers or farm wineries that also have retail, the Department of Ag is going to be regulating them. And for our retail, our bars, restaurants, liquor stores, it's the Department of Health. And we work with both agencies. We are the licensing agency. They do the food licensing. They do the food handlers. and we rely on the Department of Ag's expertise with regard to production-grade equipment.
Representative Allen, follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I thank you for that clarification on that. It's just nice to know there's at least some overlap in terms of agencies and what they're covering and making sure everything is taken care of. So thank you for that.
And our final member question in this segment comes from Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a comment more than a question, but following up on Representative Finke's comments, I had a similar experience. I went to bought a 24-pack of Summit Nialis at Costco 2 weeks ago and was carded. But I've been one. I know we're going to have testimony with people today about the anachronism that 3.2 has become. We're about the only state that has that category of beer anymore. But I've been wondering pretty much the same thing that Representative Finke is wondering, is that if 3.2 goes away, non-alcoholic beer is the single largest growing category of beer right now. Why aren't the retailers who are currently stocking 3.2 just stocking 0.5 instead? There's lots of good selections out there, including from local brewers.
Representative Elkins, that is a question for the retailer and
it
for
is.
Their business model, I would suspect. And if they see a shift in a market, they will probably shift toward that market. Mm-hmm. But again, that's the business's decision. As Mr. Magnus said, that they may choose other product mixes. And I think he said as shelf space is premium. So
yeah.
With that, thank you both for your time here today. And our final presenter this morning on our agenda is Laura Wade from the Minnesota Gaming Control Board. And again, if there's anyone who is interested in sharing some thoughts here towards the end of the committee that's from the audience today or from the public, we'll certainly give you a couple moments here as well. Ms. Wade, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Wade. Thanks for having us here. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you about charitable gambling. I'll keep my comments relatively short, but we'll, of course, be open to questions that you may have at the end. Thank you to House Research. They did a great job doing an overview of what charitable gambling is in Minnesota. So there's going to be a little bit of repetition in what I'm going to say, but I did want to just clarify one thing. It is not limited to just 501c3 organizations. They do have to be a nonprofit, but if it was just 501c3 organizations, that would exclude like veterans organizations, which are classified as like a 501c19.
Ms. Wade, pardon the interruption, but I think you're going to have to pull that just a little closer to the mic. We've been having that trouble all session. There's just a kind of a small little dead zone there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
It can be easy to get distracted or maybe even confused by the name charitable gambling or lawful gambling. In fact, as a parent with kids and activities, I always dread the question of what do you do for a living? Because it's hard to imagine explaining something that everybody has probably seen in their life, which is a pull tab at a bar or a restaurant, but explaining why that exists or how it exists. But this is what I'd like you to know and hopefully remember. Lawful gambling is most commonly known around the state as charitable gambling, and it's known as charitable gambling for a great reason. It's run by over 1,000 Minnesota charities and nonprofits, and the funds raised benefit charities and nonprofits and communities across the state. That's things like youth hockey, local food shelves, scholarships, VFW and Legion halls, fire trucks, service dogs. It's in towns like Baudette and Fairmont, in Duluth and Blaine and St. Paul. And yes, the state bars and game manufacturers and distributors get their share too. But again, think about charitable gambling as something run exclusively by charities and nonprofits, and something that charities and nonprofits run to make a difference in the communities all across Minnesota. So let's talk a little bit more about what charitable gambling is, what it isn't, and what kind of impact it has in our state, and the role that the Gambling Control Board plays in all of this. You can find a summary of this information in one of the first of the two handouts that we gave you. This information is going to be covered, so you don't have to follow along, but if you want to reference it, it's good to go back to that. So first of all, what is charitable gambling? Charitable gambling is conducted primarily in bars and clubs and consists of pull tabs and bingo, and those are paper and electronic versions of both of those, raffles, tip boards, and paddle wheels. It is these five games, and that's it. But the combination of those five games made a $4.9 billion, that's a B, $4.9 billion industry in Minnesota last year. That's the largest in the nation. And because it's something confusing, let's take a minute to say what charitable gambling isn't. It's not the lottery, it's not the tribal nations' casinos, and it's not horse racing. Charitable gambling is the fourth leg of the table, but that leg is $4.9 billion in sales that pales at almost $4.2 billion in prizes, that sends $170 million to the state, and that last year made roughly $140 million available for community needs across Minnesota. Things like $17 million for youth activities and sports, almost $8 million for education and scholarships, $4 million to address the challenges of our citizens with disabilities, to fight poverty, and to fight homelessness. $140 million is a big number. Any number with seven zeros is an impressive number, but impressive doesn't always mean important. What's important are the people this funding is helping and the difference this funding is making for our communities. The places across the state where charities and nonprofits are creating the charitable and charitable gambling. In Eveleth, the Eveleth Elks has given away close to $250,000 each year to their town and surrounding communities. One of the largest donations they've made recently was to the City of Eveleth Emergency Services Department to upgrade the equipment on the local ambulance. But thanks to the mutual aid agreement, these improvements won't just serve Eveleth. They'll enhance emergency responses across 10 surrounding communities and townships. That's the charitable and charitable gambling. In Waseca, they just celebrated the 75th anniversary of the Waseca Sleigh and Cutter Festival. 75% of their budget comes from charitable gambling funds. Participants came from throughout the country and surrounding area. Hundreds marched in one of the largest parades that they've ever had, and thousands lined the parade route. It's the longest running such event in the nation. That's the charitable and charitable gambling. And in Ham Lake, the Ham Lake Lions Club was able to help the Ringler family buy a specially built bicycle for their daughter, Olivia, who is living with a degenerative disorder that has no known cure. This isn't just any bicycle. It's being custom designed and built for Olivia in Germany, and it should ship this month, arriving in plenty of time for the family to be able to spend a summer biking together. That's the charitable and charitable gambling. We have 1,160 licensed organizations across the state of Minnesota, another 3,000 that use special permits to conduct smaller events. The impact is real, and it matters. So how does the Gambling Control Board fit into all of this? I became the executive director of the board almost a year ago, but I had previously spent 10 years working with the agency, and I came back to the agency for two reasons. I know what a difference charitable gambling makes in these communities, and I also know that the industry, for it to work, it has to have integrity. And that's what the Gambling Control Board does. We create the resources and regulation that makes sure that this $4.9 billion, all cash for the record, industry runs fairly and effectively. This includes site inspections, compliance reviews, licensing restrictions, investigations, game approvals, education and outreach, and like today, providing information to the general public, lawmakers, and stakeholders. We have a staff of 50, a budget of $6 million, which comes from regulatory fees paid by our licensees. We have offices in Roseville, Furkas Falls, Hibbing, and Mankato. And to do this work, our regulatory staff drove just over 65,000 miles last year, which is enough miles to drive around the world almost 2.5 times. But we're happy to do that to make sure that our industry runs with integrity. People only play games like pull tabs and bingo when they know that the games are fair. And last year was another record breaker for charitable gambling activity. So that's a very short introduction to the Gambling Control Board, and more importantly, to charitable gambling. I'd like to take a minute to update you regarding the legislative changes for the legislature made in 2023. This is the second handout, and there were four main parts to that bill. The first was restrictions that were placed on certain features of electronic pull tabs. There was a reduction in the number of organizations required to have a CPA audit each year. There was a tax cut and a cap on how much distributors could charge for electronic pull tab games. The electronic pull tab game restrictions became fully effective about 8 weeks ago, so on January 1st. And our very preliminary data shows a decrease in January and February electronic pull tab sales compared to last year. However, sales across all gambling forms have been down slightly since November, making it difficult to determine how much the restrictions themselves accounted for the downturn. And just in the last couple of weeks, there are indications that sales might be rebounding. But basically, at this point, it's too early to tell. Our data sample is really small. Next, there was the reduction in the number of organizations required to have a CPA audit each year. Because organizations won't see the effect of audit changes until later this year, FY26, we don't yet have any data on those savings. There was also an organization tax cut, which went into effect the beginning of FY24. And last year, organizations paid about $16 million less in taxes than they would have without the change. And finally, at the beginning of FY25, the cap on how much distributors can charge for electronic pull tab games became effective. That rate cap will save organizations roughly $14 million per year. And I wanted to quickly address the problem gambling in terms of how the Gambling Control Board is directly involved with that or indirectly involved with that. So for charitable gambling organizations, they're required to have the 1-888-HOPE phone number listed on their house rules, so that has to be available to all players. They're also, organizations are also able to make a lawful gambling donation if they've got either a specific member who's having a problem with problem gambling. Obviously, we would encourage them to make that donation to the treatment facility and not to the individual. And then also there is 0.5% of the tax revenue that's deposited into the general fund from charitable gambling revenue goes to the Commissioner of Human Services for compulsive gambling problems. So that's something that we kind of have a little bit of control over in terms of allowing the donations, and then also part of the revenue goes for those services. I'll leave it there for today, but I hope you'll remember that it's known as charitable gambling for a great reason. This $4.9 billion a year industry is run by Minnesota charities and nonprofits, and the funds it raises benefit charities and nonprofits in the communities across our state. And that's the charitable and charitable gambling. And I'll stand for any questions.
Ms. Wade, thank you. I have one member question I'm aware of, Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. My question is, how many new licensing for charitable gambling do you license every year? Is there a cap on that, or?
Ms. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's not a cap on that. I would say in general, we have like a rotation of about 30 new licenses a year, and we lose about 30 licenses a year. So we're really just for the most part replacing existing organizations who close like because they're not making enough money, or they find out that it's a lot more work than what they're getting out of it.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, you mentioned a story of a individual that benefited from charitable gambling, and I think we appreciate those stories, no question. You also mentioned there's $4.9 billion in revenue or generated.
Representative Heintzman, if you could pull your mic a little closer, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. $4.9 billion in revenue or revenue generated around charitable gambling. And I may have missed it in your comments, but I was curious. I know there's been discussion in the past about what percentage of every dollar that is raised goes to what categories. So I'm assuming that we have a pretty good idea, a ballpark idea at least, what percentage of that dollar goes actually towards those stories like you shared at the very beginning and helping people or whatever the charity is working towards supporting in their community. You might have that information today. If you do, great. Otherwise, maybe offline.
Ms. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So one thing on the handouts, there is a QR code for our annual report. So all of this information is in there. I did bring it with me today. So if we're looking at donations or what we would call mission-related expenditures, so that would be your gross receipts, less prizes paid, and then not including taxes. It was 18% of the net receipts that charities were able to use to donate back to their communities for mission-related expenditures.
Representative Hewitt.
Real quick, and I don't want an amount. I just want an offline question for you about how many, is there a percentage of what they have to keep on hand and a percentage about how much they have to keep in the bank or put in the bank for security reasons, and I don't want a dollar amount. I just want to know, is there any rules around that?
Ms. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. You know, we look at that from an internal controls perspective. So yes, there we do have requirements on like when you have to deposit your money. What we don't have a requirement on is how much they can keep on hand for like their cash banks in order to operate. So that's something that we usually advise on in terms of keeping the bare minimum of what you need to operate instead of keeping large cash banks that you could be targeted for.
Representative West has the final question this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions, but one of them was Representative Heinzman's question. My question is about the membership of the board. We have different boards in Minnesota, like the Racing Commission and the Gambling Control Board, that deal in these areas. There's a variety of individuals that appoint to the board, mostly the governor, but also the attorney general. Are there any provisions around conflict of interest of members of the Gambling Control Board who would be overseeing these, or do these individuals have full authority to appoint whoever they wish?
Ms. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not fully versed on the selection process. I will say that we all are under the conflict of interest statute in terms under 349 and of what we can do. And obviously we pay attention for our appointees to make sure that they would recuse themselves if we, for example, most of our board members either are in communities that have licensed organizations or might be members themselves of a licensed organization, that we're at least made aware if there would be any conflict of interest if they're, you know, one of the members or one of the organizations from their community were to come up for action upon a board.
Representative West, you say you had a second question, or are we in good shape? All right. There really was no action items before the committee, and I did say that I would give anyone who felt they had a burning desire to address the committee today to give you a few moments. Is there anyone who would like to address the committee at this time? Very, very briefly. We will have at some point in the future in this committee, if not this year, next year, bills that relate to the topics that were being discussed today. Seeing no one being identified, members, two housekeeping things for you. If you would be so kind as to remove from your folders anything that you do not wish to keep and stack that, it just makes it easier for staff and for processing the paperwork and being able to get folks in and out of the room. So, again, a stack of stuff that you don't need or want to take with you. You do have your save folder that you can put information in. And with that, seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned, and our next meeting is Thursday, the 28th. We are adjourned.